This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. It's Veterans Day. Today, we'll hear the stories of veterans.
It's a huge issue in a democracy, is the degree to which the society is connected to its military.
We'll look at how the shrinking number of Americans who serve in the military has created a divide.
We'll also take you to a French Medal of Honor ceremony in northern Colorado for World War II veterans, and then to the roof of the world, the Arctic, where the military is contending with climate change.
That's coming up.
It's Monday, November 11th. You're listening to Colorado Edition's special Veterans Day coverage. I'm Erin O'Toole. With me is KUNC's military and investigative reporter, Michael DeJoanna.
Hi, Erin.
You have traveled to and reported from quite a few places, a chemical weapons depot in Pueblo, a remote NORAD radar site on the Bering Strait, a radio station in Fort Collins with strategic importance.
Mm-hmm. I guess I did get around this year. Another place I went was Fort Carson Army Post in Colorado Springs. That's where I first encountered something that's become a theme in several of my stories this year. It's called the civilian-military divide.
Can you explain what that means?
That's basically where a lot of Americans who are unaware of the sacrifices involved with military service and also the benefits because they don't have any connection to the military, like a family member or a good friend who's serving. It came up in May when I sat down with Sergeant Thomas Simpson.
We've been at war so long that a lot of people have kind of forgotten that we're still in active combat overseas in several theaters.
He was sharing this sense that he has that people simply are not paying attention to or even aware of the kinds of sacrifices soldiers make. The context was that he'd lost his buddy, Specialist Joseph Coletti. Coletti died on March 22nd during a firefight in Afghanistan.
As long as you're continuing to speak their name, continuing to share stories about them, they're not truly gone anymore, and making sure they're not forgotten.
That's the music from the memorial for Coletti on Fort Carson. His family was there. His name was placed on the post's wall for troops who have lost their lives in the war on terror. And all of this happened to be going on as Memorial Day weekend approached. Sergeant Simpson told me about his picnic plans with a somber tone where he and his fellow troops would at some point remember Coletti and other fallen friends.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this divide you're talking about plays out.
It made me stop and think about how Memorial Day is a holiday where most people let loose and usher in the summer. For combat veterans like Simpson, it's obviously deeply personal.
Right. So what is creating this divide? I mean, is it politics?
No, not really. People who are drawn to serve tend to shy away from politics. The driver is about the disconnect between families that serve and families that don't. If you go back a couple of decades, 40% of Americans had a parent in the military. Today, that number is just 15%.
That's huge. And it must have been 40 years ago that Vietnam War veterans were coming of age, raising families.
Right. And there was a draft for that war. So many families were involved whether they wanted to be or not. But Afghanistan is America's longest running war. And as you know, it's been fought by people who volunteer. A nonpartisan group of experts is looking at this trend, including Janine Davidson. You might know her as the president of Metropolitan State University of Denver.
Right, right.
But she's a former undersecretary of the Navy from the Obama administration and a former military pilot. She thinks declining news coverage of wars may be contributing to the divide.
It's good news, bad news. On the one hand, sometimes people in the military, they don't want what they're doing to be hyper-politicized or misinterpreted, and when there's all kinds of news and attention. On the other hand, it's so far removed from people's day-to-day lives.
Now Davidson is serving as a member of the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, which next year will make recommendations on how to increase engagement in national service.
A large percentage of people that are in the military are sons and daughters or grandsons and granddaughters of people that have served.
She says military recruiters tend to get their enlistees from southern or western states, and the commission is wary about that.
If you're trying to solve the problem of do you have enough people, you're going to do that. If you're trying to solve a different problem as well, which is do we have a military that's reflective of the population of the United States, then you're going to have to spend more money, and you're going to have to go to different parts of the country, and you're going to have to market differently, which is one of the major recommendations you'll likely see in the report.
Are recruiting practices fueling the divide?
In part, but not in the way most of us think. The military today is more racially and ethnically diverse than ever before. About 40% of active duty troops are from racial and ethnic minorities. That's up from 25% in 1990. And there are more women serving than before, and all roles are open to them.
Right. What might a recruiting campaign look like then to get more young people from around the country interested in military service?
Well, one possibility is to emphasize the experiences ahead, including the social one of getting outside a bubble, wherever that might be, and meeting people who come from a different background than you do. Veterans talk about this aspect of service a lot.
They go to different parts of the country. They learn things from other people. And so it made us even more committed to this idea of service as a way to strengthen our civil society.
Another would be education, so that younger people know they need to stay out of trouble to qualify or work hard to meet the physical fitness requirements. Even tattoos can be a barrier to getting in.
That would be good to know before you get a tattoo.
Right. Yeah. And one more quick point. Service doesn't just mean the military. The commission says more needs to be done to make people aware of programs like AmeriCorps or Habitat for Humanity. Now I want to share the voice of an Afghanistan veteran I met earlier this year in Fort Collins. His name is Ryan Lanham, and he wouldn't wish war on anyone. It was a nightmare for him, but he's found that writing about his experiences is healing. He's working on a book in the master's writing program at Colorado State University.
Yes, I'm working on my project. It's going to have, you know, its place in the public. But what about all the people who are silenced?
What does he mean there by silenced?
That many veterans don't feel supported enough to talk about their experiences. So he wants them to do what he's doing, write about them. It's a proven way to heal. Department of Veterans Affairs research says it can heighten a sense of belonging for veterans, reduce symptoms of post-traumatic stress, which is one of the signature wounds of the recent wars.
Now, I know this project just got underway in the fall.
Yeah, Lanham still has openings for writers. So if you're interested, there's information available at KUNC.org. And while we're talking about writing, here's the voice of an aspiring reader.
Yeah. He's a soldier.
His name is Sebastian Morris Stearns. He's 2 years old and lives in Arvada with his parents.
Kind of helicopter.
Yeah. Helicopter.
Yeah. He's so cute.
Yeah. Sebastian is asking his mom, Erin Morris, and his dad, Travis Stearns, about the pictures he's looking at in one of his books. It's called Who is Sam the Soldier?
Well, it sounds like he's having fun.
He was. And to be honest, Erin wasn't sure if Sebastian would sit still while I recorded them.
Right.
Both of his parents are Army veterans who served in Afghanistan. And his mom, who works as a lawyer by day, is moonlighting as a children's book author. In other words, she wrote this book.
Oh, so she's reading her own book to Sebastian.
Right. She wrote it to bust some of the myths that kids have about the Army.
What kind of myths?
Well, during a show and tell, 8-year-old kids that Morris met were surprised when she told them that she was a soldier. Morris realized when they didn't see her as a soldier, they couldn't see themselves as one. And she wants kids to know that practically anyone, women, people from any background, can be a soldier if they work for it. The book chronicles a typical day in the life of Private First Class Sam Smith, who works as a mechanic, hangs out with friends, helps people when needed.
This is Sam Smith. He is a soldier in the United States Army. See, that's Sam.
Sam.
Yeah? Here, look at this one. What is the Army? The United States Army is the oldest and largest branch in the armed forces. The Army is made up of soldiers from all over the world with different genders, religions, ethnicities, and races. The Army is very diverse.
I love that the book has cartoons that capture this diversity.
Yes, and as I said, the military has made strides in terms of diversity, and it has been very proud of that.
And that's very apparent when you hear from veterans like Erin Morris.
Right, but for one group, the military recently walked back its promise about diversity. I'm talking about transgender troops, which were in the news this year.
The backstory to this starts in 2016. That's when the Pentagon announced that it would end its ban on transgender troops. In other words, allow them to serve openly.
Exactly. And after that, many transgender troops breathed a sigh of relief. Some came forward to serve in their preferred gender, including Army Captain Olivia Stelic at Fort Carson.
I left work on a Friday and then I showed up on Monday with a different name and different pronouns and some makeup, right? That's, I mean, because I didn't have long hair at the time. And folks were remarkably gracious and lovely and kind, and it was wonderful.
Stelic is a graduate of West Point who is now a physical therapist, and she told me her story earlier this year. She transitioned in 2017, and not long after she did, President Trump tweeted that the U.S. government would not allow or accept transgender individuals to serve in the military in any capacity.
I didn't actually know it had happened. My first patient of the morning came in and said, "I don't care what anybody says, I want you to be my physical therapist."
The policy the Defense Department eventually issued didn't exactly match what the president said in his tweet. What happened was defense officials put in place a policy that blocks transgender troops from enlisting if they are open in the preferred gender or have a mental health history of what's called gender dysphoria, which is a state of feeling the mismatch between one's gender identity and biological sex.
Right. So does this mean Captain Stelic has to leave the Army?
No. The military is allowing those who transitioned in this small window when the ban was dropped to continue to serve. And Stelic says she loves serving, the people are good, and she intends to stay.
It's like family. That's I can't overstate how much this has opened communication with soldiers and with leaders and with people everywhere, folks that I don't think would have talked to me before.
Those are a few stories that take a deeper look into the lives of those who serve and those who have served.
In just a moment, we'll look at threats the military is facing and the technology, old and new, they're using to fight them. You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC. As I mentioned earlier, Michael, you traveled far and wide this year for many military stories, although one of those places was pretty close, right here in northern Colorado.
At the tone, 18 hours, 1 minute, Coordinated Universal Time.
Now playing on WWV Radio, pulses every second, followed by an announcement of the exact time.
Truly riveting programming.
Yeah, WWV is a little-known radio station tucked away in the farmland north of Fort Collins. I promise that WWV is more exciting than this.
All right, well, you were at the station in October when it marked its 100th anniversary. It's run by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and it's linked to the atomic clock in Boulder.
Yes, and questions abound as to why, in our digital age, the government would fund or should fund a radio station that basically transmits what time it is. There was even talk recently of shuttering the station to save money. But did you know that WWV is also an important safety net?
Your attention, please. The Ohio Emergency Management Agency will hold communications exercise.
Yeah, that's a little bit hard to hear, Michael.
I know. It's the Ohio National Guard as heard on a ham radio. Fuzzy tape that was given to me by U.S. Northern Command, the military's Homeland Defense Command headquartered here in Colorado. It's from a training exercise, a scenario where WWV's high-frequency signal comes into play. That signal can be heard around the world if you have a shortwave radio, and because of that, it could be used to coordinate local and federal officials during a disaster where regular communications are wiped out or unavailable.
Like no cell phones.
Right, and no computers and so on. I mean, imagine being cut off. No texting. The list goes on. That could happen in a limited nuclear attack or even from extreme solar activity. Perhaps it's unlikely, but the military wants to be prepared just in case. So there's what's called the Military Auxiliary Radio System, also known as MARS. Radio operators around the world would essentially save the day with WWV. Here's Paul English. He's chief of the Army's Mars program.
We would look at WWV as a source to get out information.
You know, this doomsday scenario where the technology of a generation ago becomes relevant again made me think of a collaborative story you did with KUNC and Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. It was about radars in the Arctic that track threats for NORAD.
Right. That's the North American Aerospace Defense Command, and also in Colorado. And there's a new threat, climate change.
Which is fascinating because that is not what I think of when I think of military security. So how is climate change a threat?
That's a big question. It's NORAD's job to scan for threats, including nuclear missile launches and aircraft. And in the last decade, NORAD operators have strangely felt like operators did during the Cold War. They're looking for and finding Russians.
What does that mean?
Russian bombers. They're called bears, and they're shockingly fast and potentially lethal, able to carry nuclear weapons. That's where these radars come in. They're part of an early warning system, and if the bombers are spotted approaching North American airspace, jets go up to meet them to see if they're really a threat, or, as an officer told me, just playing cat and mouse.
Wow. So what is then going on with the radars?
They were built in the 1950s, and three of the ones in the Alaskan Arctic that are critical to NORAD's mission are in peril because of climate change. Just one NORAD station, the one at Cape Lisburn in northwest Alaska, will cost $48 million to upgrade, including building a mile-long seawall. And that's no easy feat in such a remote area.
I can imagine. Now, is this because of melting sea ice?
Yes. According to the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, this year was a record low for the extent of sea ice. And that's following a decline that's been decades in the making.
So you traveled to Alaska to check out one of these radars.
I flew with the Air Force from a base in Anchorage to a place that few people have seen, the Bering Strait. There's a radar there that looks like a golf ball perched atop a perfectly cone-shaped mountain. It's not threatened by climate change, but I did get to see how important these radars are from that site, as well as a view of Russia. So I hopped into a bulldozer-like vehicle called a piston bully with a cabin in the back with a guy named Colonel Dan Lemon.
This vehicle's like out of the movie Transformers or something, you know.
They tell me the journey will take about an hour along a steep, winding road carved into the side of the mountain, just wide enough to fit the bully going one way, up or down, and nothing else. The bully rocks as the driver hops into the cab, which is separate from us. So the colonel speaks to him by walkie-talkie.
Everybody ready?
Ready.
A plow on the front clears snow and ice as we begin rumbling up the road. About a year ago, Colonel Lemon says a huge storm iced over the door that leads to the radar. Troops had to be called in to hack away at it. Anytime there's a problem with the radar here, there's a problem at NORAD 2.
They don't like sites being down, and we try to get them back up for them.
The piston bully creaks and churns as we climb switchback after switchback. The views get more harrowing. I'm on the inside, the mountainside. The colonel's chief is sitting on the other side, looking straight down. He says the track is right off the edge of the cliff. Several of us sit back deeper in our seats, gripping our gear tighter.
All right, everybody got to hang on. We're going to go down a little hill.
Okay, we're going to go down a little hill, so then hang on.
And then we'll spin around and bring it back up to the core.
Thank God they told us that, right?
The piston bully comes to rest on a small hill in front of the radar. There's a porch extending out from the doorway that looks almost like cake with layers and layers of vanilla icing spray painted on. Our driver chips away with a shovel before opening the door. We enter the radar room. It's filled with buzzing machinery. I wonder, how far across the Bering Strait can the radar see?
In terms of how powerful the radar is it one of the more powerful radars?
Could I tell them the range?
No, we can't.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
You can't say how what the range
nope.
is.
Nope. I know what it is, but I'm not telling you. I can't.
Is that classified?
It's classified. Okay. Most everything up here is classified. I will tell you that.
I climb up a small flight of metal stairs, and now I'm under the radar. as close as I'll get to it. Just above my head, electromagnetic waves pulse and travel some classified distance away. Right now, this whirring, whooshing relic is guarding against nuclear attack. And it's connected to a string of other radars doing the same thing. Together, they're that tripwire, that early warning. And because of climate change, they're vulnerable. When permafrost is no longer perma, when sea ice just becomes sea, climate change is not only a problem for the military in the Arctic. Former Navy Secretary Ray Mabus told me that the world's largest naval base in Norfolk, Virginia, will disappear. It will go underwater in our lifetimes. Many in Congress are concerned about the threats to security and the costs, including Representative Jason Crow, a Democrat from Aurora and an Army veteran.
We have installations, hundreds of installations throughout the world that are being impacted tremendously from extreme weather, sea level rise, ocean surges, wildfires, droughts, and a number of environmental factors that are becoming more acute.
That's an excerpt from a piece that you produced for the public radio program Reveal, which originally aired in June. Now, Michael, in your reporting, you also found that one of the Army's top 10 sites at risk for climate change is here in Colorado.
That's right. The Army's Pueblo Chemical Depot. The threat there is what's called desertification.
As in turning into a desert.
Yes. And the thing is that it's already dry at the depot. It's going to get drier in the years ahead, and that ups the risk for wildfire and drought.
And that is concerning because of what the depot holds, stockpiles of old chemical weapons.
Yes. There are hundreds of thousands of mortars and shells there, and they contain really nasty stuff, mustard gas. Before the atomic bomb, these were the worst weapons imaginable. They were manufactured in the 1940s just outside of Denver at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which is now a wildlife refuge. The idea was that they'd be used for an all-out war with Germany if the Nazis used them first. So they were sent to the depot in Pueblo, ready to be shipped out for war, but actually they've just been there ever since.
And under international treaty, they have to be destroyed by 2023. A process that's already underway. Will climate change and desertification get in the way of that?
The depot says no, but they also concede they don't have a plan to address climate change there. When I visited, they showed me how they're prepared in terms of firefighting capacity, even ready to get help from other departments if need be. And also, they have a system of self-sufficient wells for water.
And so what about the deadline to destroy all of those weapons?
The depot says it's on track to meet it, perhaps even a year ahead of schedule.
And I know you'll keep following that story for us. In the meantime,
First Lieutenant Layla Morrison.
Let's wrap up our Veterans Day show with something very special that took place earlier this year.
Layla Morrison, au nom du président de la République.
That's an official from France pinning his country's highest award on Army Lieutenant Layla Morrison of Windsor. That's the Legion of Honor Medal. It was for her work during World War II, taking care of troops as shells exploded all around her, and later caring for prisoners freed from the Nazis' Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany.
Now, how was it that she was recognized all these years later?
Well, it was thanks to the work of a local veterans advocate, Brad Hoops, who documents veterans' stories. He told me that he wanted to do more, so he petitioned France to recognize Morrison and several other veterans.
It's amazing that he was able to accomplish that. Also receiving honors were Staff Sergeant Philip Daly of Brighton, a B-17 tail gunner who was shot down on his 25th mission, a prisoner of war and survivor of a forced winter march.
Second Lieutenant William Powell of Fort Collins, a B-24 pilot who became a prisoner of war after his plane was shot down.
Staff Sergeant Harry Marincelli of Fort Collins, a ball turret gunner on a B-17 Flying Fortress who beat the odds and made it to his required 35th mission.
Lieutenant Armin Sedgley of Lakewood, a B-17 Flying Fortress bombardier who was shot down off the coast of Corsica.
And posthumously, Captain Joe Graham, a tank commander remembered privately. His son, Jack, of Fort Collins, accepted the honor for his dad. Thank you so much for joining us for our Veterans Day special. Michael DeJuana, thank you for being our guide.
You're welcome.
If you're interested in digging deeper on any of these stories, you can explore online at KUNC.org. I'm Erin O'Toole. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. Colorado Edition is a production of KUNC. Lily Tyson is our producer, and our executive producer is Brian Larson. Our theme music was composed by Colorado musicians Brianna Harris and Johnny Burrows. Other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. Join us tomorrow for another episode of Colorado Edition.